So the Heart Sutra, as we've talked about before, is a part of the Prajnaparamita collection of texts, this perfection of wisdom. And it's a class of Mahayana materials. And it's really, rather than just focusing on wisdom, it's this idea of combining wisdom with compassion, and that at the ultimate, they kind of fuse to become one. You can't really have one without the other in terms of Buddhism. There's a saying, isn't there, that it takes all the work of the wise to undo the harm done by the merely good. So this idea that, you know, you might want to do good, but without wisdom you can actually do quite a lot of harm. So we need wisdom and we need compassion together. One without the other is just not good enough. Now the Prajnaparamita texts, as I mentioned last week, I think, sort of grew. You can get the Prajnaparamita in 8,000 lines, Prajnaparamita in 10,000 lines, 18,000 lines, 25,000 lines, and 100,000 lines. So they all expanded out to try and explain this idea of perfection of wisdom. Then they went through a process of contraction again. So we ended up with, one of the results of that was the Heart Sutra, the essence of the perfection of wisdom texts. So there were shorter versions such as the Heart Sutra and also the Diamond Sutra, which touches on this topic, which incidentally is apparently the world's oldest known dated printed book. So that's the Diamond Sutra. My pen. We talk about Prajna. Prajnaparamita. Well, this Prajna bit is roughly translated as wisdom. I've got a couple of other quotations, though. Prajna is the wisdom that is able to extinguish afflictions and bring about enlightenment. So it's spiritual wisdom, Buddhist spiritual wisdom in this context. A direct realization of Buddhist concepts. So rather than just a mere understanding, it's a direct realization in one's, you know, very being. So that's prajna, spiritual wisdom. Another term that sometimes gets bandied about is jnana, which is related. It's also sometimes translated as wisdom. It can be called pure awareness that is free of conceptual encumbrances, as opposed to vijnana, which we talked about last week, one of the five skandhas, the skandha of consciousness. Which is a divided consciousness. So jnana is a consciousness imbued with the spiritual wisdom. Now, just to go back to what I was talking about earlier, in the Heart Sutra, Avalokiteshvara talks about the Four Noble Truths and the Noble Eightfold Paths, where he says, nor is there pain, or cause of pain, or cease in pain, or a noble path to lead from pain. What he's trying to get at here is that there is a danger with all of these concepts, any Buddhist concept, any concept full stop, that we will think we've got a handle on them. We will think we understand it. We think we know what it's about. If we think, yes, I understand Buddhism, I understand what enlightenment's like because I understand this, that, or the other. If we think that, then we've made a mistake. It's a trap that we continually fall into as human beings, though, because I think it's the way our minds work. We like to compartmentalise things. We like to try and get a handle on things, understand them, and put them away, squirrel them away there. Right, so I understand that now, put that way there. It's uncomfortable to think, I've kind of got a bit of an understanding of this, but I don't fully realise it. I won't fully realise it for some time. My understanding is merely provisional. So what he's trying to get at here is that the danger of having this fixed idea, of fixating on some concept, just in the same way that we tend to treat things, our objects, our possession, as fixed, unchanging entities. So we can do the same thing with concepts. Both approaches are dangerous. As Vasantara says in Meeting the Buddha's book, our experience is ungraspable. And even concepts of Buddhism do not capture the truth of things. That's an interesting statement. Our experience is ungraspable. So even our every day-to-day experience is actually ungraspable. When you try to really think, what is this that I'm experiencing? What is happening? What is life? What is my experience right now? It is actually ungraspable. Which is why there's often a great deal of emphasis in certain schools for focusing on just being in the here and now and being aware of what's happening. And even concepts of Buddhism do not capture the truth of things. And of course they cannot, because how can you describe reality in words or pictures or any other concept? As soon as you try to describe it, as eloquent as you may be, or as gifted an artist as you may be, you're going to fall short in some way, shape or form. You're never going to be able to describe perfectly what reality is in mere words. Words aren't sufficient vehicles to do it. Nothing is a sufficient vehicle to do it. Even if you were able to write brilliantly, people are still likely to misunderstand anyway. So, what Avalokiteshvara is saying in the Heart Sutra is avoid attachment to concepts. The Four Noble Truths, the Noble Eightfold Path, the 12 Nidanas, whatever it might be. That's not to say they're not valuable, because of course they are. That's not what he's trying to say. It's very well worth learning about them, practicing them, reflecting them. Just don't get too fixed on them. Just don't get too certain about it, if you like. All of these concepts ultimately are discarded anyway, once we get to enlightenment. We don't need to worry about the Four Noble Truths, the Noble Eightfold Path, the 12 Nidanas, or anything else, once we're enlightened, because we just act spontaneously, skillfully. So we don't need to worry about any concepts. And another thing to be aware of, and another thing that is mentioned, is this thing of attainment. Avoiding seeing Buddhism as a path of attainment. Something that you can see when people are seeking ordination. I think it can tend to be, particularly amongst men perhaps, this idea of trying to attain things and get achievements and tick boxes, and that idea as you move towards getting ordained, for example, or something like that. You know, it can be a danger, this idea of trying to attain something, you know, like a qualification or something. So again, avoiding seeing Buddhism simply as a path of attainment, where you simply attain different things, you bolt things onto yourself. Attaining positive qualities, attaining wisdom, whatever it is. Because attainment too is emptiness. There are many apparent contradictions in Buddhism. And of course you mentioned one earlier. So for example, this idea of, in some schools, they talk about how we are inherently enlightened. We have this Buddha mind within ourselves. Whereas in other contexts, you can talk about the need to develop. Clearly, we need to practice. We need to practice the various Noble Eightfold Path, Four Noble Truths, and so on. So there's this apparent contradiction, this idea of being inherently pure, and on the other hand, needing to purify ourselves or to develop certain qualities. Similarly, there can be an idea of removing fetters that stand in our way, our limitation, contrasting that with developing compassion and wisdom. There's the two models in the two principal schools of Buddhism. The Arahants, which from the most traditional school of Buddhism, this idea of attaining enlightenment, to liberate oneself, which is what the Buddha's followers attempted to do, and his principal disciples all became Arahants, gaining enlightenment so that they liberated themselves. And then this development in the Mahayana tradition of the Bodhisattva idea, where you attain enlightenment not for yourself, but to help all other living beings. So you put off any final enlightenment so that you can continually be reborn in order to help other living beings. So they've got these apparent contradictions. But these are all models. And any model, by its very nature, is not the real thing. Another important point, I think, is this idea of relative and absolute truth. An example of the relevant... So, for example, this bowl here. A relative truth is that the bowl is solid. I mean, for most intents and purposes, you would consider this to be solid. Solid material. But in actual fact, it's not solid at all. Most of them, if you analyse it at the atomic level, then actually it's mostly space between the various different atomic particles, or subatomic particles. So there's more space in here than there is solid material. I think they say it's something like a hydrogen atom is a bit like a fly flying around inside a cathedral. That's how much sort of material there is contained compared to how much space there is. So this isn't solid at all. There's much more space in here than there is solid material. And even then, the so-called solid material, these atomic particles and stuff, aren't really solid at all. They're just, as far as we know, they're sort of various probability waves and so on. We're not really quite sure what they are. We don't even know whether they're particles or waves. So to say it's solid is ridiculous, isn't it, really? But, of course, from a relative truth point of view, it's fair enough to say it's solid. But when we look at the absolute truth, that's not quite that simple. And the same could be said of let's say you were trying to explain to a small child. I think often children, perhaps all children, maybe not all children, but a lot of children go through the stage where they get to a certain age, maybe a relative's died, and they start thinking about life and death, or more particularly their own death, I suppose, their own mortality. They have this sudden awareness that they are actually mortal. And then they start quite upset and start asking questions. It can be quite a difficult thing to try and explain life and death to a small, upset child. And you may want to do it in quite a gentle way, in a way that is not untrue, but a way that is relatively true. That's to say, it spares them perhaps some of the more unpleasant details. You're not going to turn around and say, well, yes, actually you are going to die. That's probably not going to be helpful. But just trying to be truthful in a more delicate and sensitive way. It might be necessary to simplify things a bit, make things a bit more palatable. And then, as the child grows older, as you grow up, you gradually learn and you understand more and more clearly about, you know, the way things are. So there's this idea of relative truth. And it could be argued that we're kind of, we could be like little children, in a sense, of our understanding of reality. It may be very difficult for us to accept the real true nature of reality. It might seem like gobbledygook to us. So we can start off with things that are a bit more acceptable, palatable, doable for us perhaps, like maybe the Noble Eightfold Path and the Four Noble Truths and other such things. So that's the idea of this idea of absolute truth and relative truth. We cannot know the absolute truth until we are actually enlightened beings. Only then can we really experience reality. Only then can we really know. Up until then, our understanding can only ever be provisional. Another useful thing to bear in mind as well is to avoid taking things too literally. Often you do see evidence of this sometimes in certain religious beliefs, don't you, where things get taken really quite literally, with unfortunate results often. I think in practice, of course, in Buddhism we don't have commandments, we have precepts, which I think is more practical. Because in reality, often we have to try and balance, I think, competing precepts. It's often not simply a case of behaving skillfully or behaving unskillfully. It's often a case of balancing, I think, what's the most skillful thing I can do in this situation, or the least harmful thing I can do in this situation, bearing in mind these various precepts. So it does put the onus on us, rather. If it's a commandment, you just simply behave, go along with it, don't you? But in our case, it's really, in the case of Buddhism, it's a question of it's the onus is on us to make what we think is the correct decision. So this is a point of avoiding attachments to precepts and to various formulations. There's a Tibetan tantric ritual that involves consuming small amounts of meat and alcohol to avoid getting attached to the idea of not eating these things and not consuming these products in a literal way. So that you have to overcome that. I'm not necessarily advocating that, by the way, but there is that particular ritual. I was told a story once about somebody I know who, and I've used this exercise in another course, where we do these ethical conundrums, but this guy who went out for a meal with a non-vegetarian. The non-vegetarian ordered some chicken dish of some sort, didn't eat it all, and then the vegetarian, who was a Buddhist, genuinely practicing their precepts and stuff, ate the leftover chicken. And the third person who was there, who was also a Buddhist vegetarian, was outraged, thinking, oh my goodness, what's he doing? Whereas the argument is, well, it's only going to be thrown in the bin anyway. No harm is going to be done by eating this chicken. So I might as well eat the chicken, hadn't I? That often causes a bit of a debate in the when we have these ethical discussions about whether it's right or whether it's wrong. There's various different points of views. But I think it goes to show that these things are not always simple and straightforward. There is a particular... there's another list. There's loads of lists of Buddhism, as you know. But there's another list called the Ten Fetters. And these are 10 things that hold us back. If we could only break these 10 fetters, then we would be enlightened. One of these 10 fetters is an attachment to rites and rituals as ends in themselves. So that's that, you know, right, I've got to do a puja every Friday night, regardless, you know. And you do it, not because it's beneficial in any way, but because that's what you do. You know, I've become attached to this routine, and this is what I do, and it's going to make me spiritual. So it's that kind of idea of being attached to things as ends in themselves, rather than for the benefit they can do you. So that can actually be a thing that holds you back. It is a thing that holds us back. So, what Avalokiteshvara is trying to get us to do here with these negations is to avoid us thinking, I know how it is, I've got an understanding of this, and rather to remind ourselves that our understanding is provisional, that they are only concepts, nothing else. They're aids to help us that can be discarded when they're no longer helpful. They are, the other expression, or another expression, is that Buddhism is a finger pointing at the moon. It's not the moon itself. And in the same way, these teachings are things to help us, to guide us. They're not the thing themselves. And once we start treating them as the thing itself, thinking, I have to behave this way, I understand what this is, if I only do this, then this will happen, then we're likely to be mistaken. So, that's what he's trying to get at, avoiding getting attached to these particular concepts. In fact, avoiding attachment to everything. And then in line 33, how he goes on. So know that the Bodhisattva, holding to nothing whatever. I do quite like that phrase, holding to nothing whatever. But dwelling in prajna wisdom is freed of delusive hindrance, rid of the fear bred by it, and reaches clearest nirvana. So this idea of holding to nothing whatever. That's not ignoring things, it's not pushing them away, it's using them when they're useful, but not holding on to them. Having a loose relationship with them, seeing them for what they are.